Let's open with a word of thanks. Father, again, we thank you for your word and your son especially. The fact that he loved us as you did and willingly died in our place. We didn't do anything. We just contributed our sin. He paid it so perfectly. We have an eternal relationship with you because it's all done. And it's just something we rest on. The more we understand, the more we can rest on what you've accomplished for us. We thank you again. We're back with Mark. And if you remember where we left off, we were just finishing up with the religious trials of Christ. And before I get there, there was something newsworthy in the news this week. There's a new archaeological discovery in Jerusalem. They've located the quarry, where the stones for the Temple Mount come from. Those huge, huge, humongous stones that even today's cranes can't lift. They've located the quarry, and so it's just another confirmation that all the history that we study in the Bible is, again, true. And it's north of the Temple Mount, as you can see from here, and it's also uphill. So when they, you know, do their business, they can run the sleds downhill. Let me get you some scale here. This area here is the Mount of Olives. This is Mount Scopus. So this is probably 2 miles or so, but it is higher elevation so they can come down. And I'll show you a few pictures of what they found. It's pretty neat that they can still find things like this. You can tell it's in the middle of the city, and this was all probably covered over to a degree where they're at. Here's another picture, and you can see how the slabs were cut out. And there's a picture here that shows how they actually channel that out. There's one already in place. You notice this one right here? They cut down a channel on each side, and then they break it loose. And they can do it, break it loose by using wood, get it with water, and it swells up, those kind of things. Just neat that stuff like this turns up all the time. And there's so much of the city that's covered over that will never get... Yeah, this is the second temple, Herod's temple, that was built. And it just goes back to the historicalness. It doesn't prove the Bible. It just confirms what we already see in God's Word. So again, just to review last week, we note that there's 3 religious trials and there are 3 civil trials. And we've gotten up to trial 2, I believe, is where we left off at. And that's what we want to start with when we begin again here in Mark. So we have 3 religious trials, Annas, Caiaphas, and then the entire Sanhedrin, at least as many as they could gather together that night. And then they take it to the Roman civil authorities, and there's a trial in front of Pilate. He sends him to Herod, and then he comes back to Pilate before the guilty verdict is proclaimed. So we're just cruising through this, and that's what we need to do. Remember I mentioned last week that the Jews needed to find a way to put Christ to death. The only ability they had for capital punishment or capital execution was if someone transpassed into the temple area. And this was a stone that actually gives that warning that we talked about on the side. If they go beyond that, they have the authority from the Romans to kill that person, even if they're a Roman citizen. So they angled all their accusations at Christ in that area. Oh, remember the 2 witnesses were supposed to prove that he said he would destroy this temple? And one said that, and the other one said, no, he's able to destroy the temple. So they couldn't agree, but they're going ahead anyway. But they couldn't even get their witnesses to agree. So that's actually a stone that's been recovered and is in the Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem. Again, confirmation, not proof. I'm not looking for that. There's even a sign today, but this is a little bit different, but the rabbis have announced that according to the Torah, it's forbidden for any person to enter the Temple Mount area due to its sacredness. So they think it's even too sacred for rabbis, Jews to go there, because who knows where the temple was really at. So that kind of thing goes on anyway. The word I wanted to comment on last time when we stopped, let's see if I see it, it's the word translated officer. Whenever we see, when Christ was arrested, let's see here. There was this mob that came up with swords and clubs, the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders, and then it talks about one of the officers or slave of the high priest, And it's this word, hupetrates. And it's kind of an interesting, colorful word. We won't spend too much time to it, but I just wanted to comment on it. It means under rower, or an underling, or a subordinate. Let me get you a picture. It comes from the idea of being an under rower. In other words, you're a subordinate. And that was a naval term initially, but it came to mean anybody that was a subordinate. And militarily, of course, it's always translated, almost always translated officer in here. So it's the security police that were used to protect the temple area were called officers or underlings, and that's the word involved. So these terms have kind of a colorful background to them. Remember, we had the Last Supper somewhere in this area. This was the traditional tomb of David, and somewhere in this area we thought there was the Last Supper. They went out, Christ was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, and then this is the wealthy or the ritzy part of town, and that's where the intellectual or the academics or the leaders usually had their residences. So we're probably coming back to the same area for Jesus' trial in front of the high priest, Annas, Caiaphas, and the Sanhedrin are probably in the same area, which is a little ironic. Okay, so we're on Nisan 15. We're on Passover Day. Passover Day started the evening before, right? So Passover starts in the day before the day. I know that seems backwards, but that's what happens. And Jewish families eat their Passover meal on Nisan 14, just the way Exodus lays out. But that's the evening, and this is now the 15th. We're, as this shows, it's kind of like a clock dial, but somewhere between 2 and 4 in the morning is probably where we're at here. And that kind of gives you a timetable where these trials are going on. We're at Mark 14:60 is where we want to pick up at. Chapter 14 and verse 60. And we probably should read through that. Let's at least go through 65, brief, but that'll be our first section to begin with. Let me start, and I'll go to Linda Overland, and we'll just go around that direction. In verse 60 of chapter 14, the high priest stood up and came forward. Well, perhaps we should go back to 53. We'll go 53 through 65. That'll give us a little more continuity. In Mark 14:53, they led Jesus away to the high priest. Now, he's already seen Annas. John recorded that. Mark didn't mention it. But they led Jesus away to the high priest, Caiaphas, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes gathered together.
And Peter had followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he was sitting with the officers and warming himself at the fire.
The one we missed was the one where it says, and the high priest was questioning, saying to him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" Well, let's look at a couple things here. This is Caiaphas, and Caiaphas was the one earlier in John that had prophesied as high priest that it would be expedient for one man to die for the nation. And yet here he becomes the man that actually has Christ in front of him and sentences him again to death. Notice how things have changed for Jesus. He used to privately tell his disciples that he was the Son of Man, the Son of God, the Father. But here now he becomes public about it. When Caiaphas asked him if he is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One, or the Son of God, Jesus says, "I am." And so now he's not holding back at all. He's just stating plainly who he is. And he also makes a little bit of a prophetic statement about the future. He says, "You shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power, and coming with the clouds of heaven." So he's pointing out that at the return, when he returns, even those dead, Caiaphas would be dead at that time, even that he will see his return. So even those who have died and are in Hades or hell will see the return of Jesus Christ. This part here at the end where it says, "Some begin to spit at him and to blindfold him and to beat him with their fists and to say to him, 'Prophesy,'" comes from a passage, and we'll look at it here in Isaiah. There was a prophecy about the Messiah that, well, let's just read Isaiah chapter 2, and we'll see where that comes from. Because it is kind of a funny thing to ask him to prophesy when the 11:2, thank you. There was an understanding from the Old Testament about the character of the Messiah, and in Isaiah chapter 11 and verse 2 and through 4, we get this information. I think it's mine, so let me start with verse 2 and we'll just keep going. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on Him, the Anointed One, the Messiah. The Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord.
And He will delight in the fear of the Lord, and He will not judge by what His eyes see, not make a decision by what His ears hear. But with righteousness He will judge the needy, with justice He will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of His mouth, with the breath of His lips He will slay the wicked.
In verse 3 it says, and He will not judge by what He sees, and He will make a decision, not make a decision by what He hears. So there was kind of an old wives' tale, if you will, or a rabbinic tradition that the Messiah would be able to know things without hearing or seeing. And that's part of what they're doing here. They're mocking Him. They're blindfolding Him. And they're not identifying themselves. And they say, okay, now tell us who it is. Prophesy. And that's part of the mocking things that will happen to Christ. There'll be 8 episodes where Christ is mocked. This is the first one. But that's why they're doing this. They're making fun of Him at this point. Also, this is the first beating of Christ. And they're beating Him with their fists. And they're spitting at Him. In Jewish law, if you beat somebody, it was a finable offense. You'd be fined for 4 days' wages for beating somebody with a fist. If you slapped somebody, that was even more severe, and that was several months of wages, a fine for doing that. You could be fined for that. But if you actually spit at somebody, and this is a fine they had in place, if you spit at somebody, that was more than a year's wages fine. So these are very severe things. Of course, nobody's going to be fined here because it's the law enforcement people, if you will, that are doing it. So, additionally, he's beat here in front of. Oh, I'm sorry. This is the second one. We're here with Caiaphas. But remember, in John 18:22, and I can turn there quick enough for you. 18:22, he was in front of Annas, and he made a response. Jesus said, I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in the synagogues and the temple where all Jews come together, and I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them, and they know what I said. In 22 he said, and when he had said this, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus, saying, is that the way you answer the high priest? So he was, first beating was in front of Annas. Second beating is this passage we're looking at here, in front of Caiaphas, and again in Luke, in front of the Sanhedrin. Let's turn over there in Luke 22. Will be the third time when Jesus, in 22 and verse 63, now the men who were holding Jesus in custody were mocking Him and beating Him, and they blindfolded Him, and they were asking Him, saying, prophesy, who is the one who hit you? So they're continuing to do this same sort of thing, and this is with the Sanhedrin. So the beatings, there's 3 episodes, and they're kind of a continuation of what's going on with. And again, that's violating their own rules, isn't it? The Jewish rules about justice were that you shouldn't beat or treat badly a prisoner, especially one that's going to be convicted. Going back to that, remember we had 21. I found another one. There's now 22 violations in this passage that they violated their own written laws about how to conduct a trial in the trial of Christ. The Jews violate their own laws. Most of these are in the second half. Let's take a look at this moving in. These are the 22 violations that occur just in the Jewish trial alone. They violate their own written rules of how to conduct a trial. And the ones we're looking at here is the high priest is forbidden to tear his clothes. He does that. The charges could not originate with the judges. And who makes the charge? Caiaphas here makes the charge and pronounces the sentence. The verdicts could only be announced in the daytime. Here they're doing it in the middle of the night. And all these about being separated by 24 hours, the trial and the sentence, they do it all in one fell swoop. There's no voting. They just, by consensus, say, yeah, he's guilty. And that's the end of that. It's unanimous. There's nobody that votes for acquittal. And they say in their own rules, if you have a unanimous verdict, that means it should be an acquittal because it's obviously a fixed trial. If you had 71 men, all vote guilty on it, same issue. The capital offense pronouncements, we're supposed to wait 3 days. They're not going to do that. The judge is supposed to be humane and kind. They're not doing that. The person sentenced to death is to not be beaten or scourged the day beforehand. And again, he's beaten. And there shouldn't be any trials on the Sabbath or the feast day. And what are we doing? We're having a trial on Passover. So they are violating their own written rules.
So they don't correct each other when one violates the law?
Well, it's a mob thing. They've known for a long time they wanted to kill Jesus. They wanted to get him out of the way.
Agreement.
Yeah, this is something they've been planning to do, and it's all a fixed kangaroo court environment. We have some other prophecies that are fulfilled again about Christ. In Isaiah 53:7b, it talks about, as a sheep is silent before the shears, he's silent before his accusers. There's another one here about he was smitten on the cheeks out of Isaiah 50 and verse 6. That's another prophetic passage from the Old Testament that's fulfilled in the person of Christ. And even though this is probably not the one we would normally use, the servant is shockingly abused. And of course he is here. Why would you do this to a defendant in a courtroom? So these are the things that are going on, which makes it all such a bogus, fixed kangaroo court environment. 22. Now we don't want to forget about our friend Peter. Peter's sitting outside while this is going on at the fire, and he has a certain episode that we want to not forget. Mark 14 and verse 54 is where we left off with Peter before we went to the information about Jesus. And in 54 it says, Peter had followed him at a distance right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he was sitting with the officers and warming himself at the fire. So Peter, after regaining his courage, they all ran off, remember. He follows along, and we know also from John that John was also there, because that's how Peter gets in, because John knows the household of the high priest. And of course, continuing on here in verse 66, so we have this little comment about Peter following along. Then we have the information now in 55 with Jesus, and then it picks up with Peter in verse 66 again. And it says, "And as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came, and seeing Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, 'You also were Jesus the Nazarene.' And he denied it, saying, 'I neither know nor understand what you were talking about.' So it's just a simple denial the first time. And he went out onto the porch, and a rooster crowed. 69, the servant girl saw him and began once more to say to the bystanders, 'This is one of them.' But again, he denied it." And we're going to find he kind of intensifies his denial each time. Again, he denied it. After a little while, verse 70, after a little while, the bystanders were again saying to Peter, "Surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean." So it's kind of like having a southerner around. You're in New York City, and a southerner comes in. You know where he came from just by the accent. and they could tell he was a Galilean. In 71, he again begins to curse and swear, "I do not know this man you are talking about." And immediately, a rooster crowed a second time, and Peter remembered how Jesus made the remark to him, "Before a rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times," and he began to weep. And again, these events are happening just as an affirmation of who Jesus is. He is deity, he's sovereign, events are in control, he knows what's going to happen. And so you have three denials here before a rooster crow. The first one is just a simple denial. The next one, he utters an oath, and that's not shown here in Mark that he gives an oath, but it is in the other synoptic gospels. And then in the third time, he elevates each time his denial, and this time he curses and swears that he doesn't know Christ. And then, of course, the rooster crows twice, and he realizes what he's done. In Luke, there's a little information that we'll add to this. In Luke 22, same event, but a little bit different information. In verse 60 to 62, it says that Peter said, "Man, I do not know what you're talking about." And immediately while he was speaking, a rooster crowed, and the Lord turned and looked at Peter. And so that's an element that Mark didn't record, but Luke did. And we kind of look at that funny, and we go, how could Jesus see Peter when he was in the courtyard? I think it's something we have to visualize, something like this courtyard that you see here. And Peter's down there, and there's a fire, and there's the servants, there's the soldiers, the crowd's down there, but Jesus is not down there. And we can note that when we had this remark in verse 66 of Mark 14, as Peter was below in the courtyard. So when the Lord looked at Peter, he was looking down in the courtyard at Peter. Yeah, he would have been at least in the second story. And that's how he could just look and see Peter. Yeah. Yeah, we can go back to that passage. Mark describes it as Peter remembered, but Peter remembers as Christ is looking at him. This thing about the rooster crows twice, he'll deny him before the rooster crows twice. I want to talk about this just a moment because this is one of the supposed mistakes in the Bible. Because the other Gospels only talk about Peter denying before the rooster crows. Only in Mark is it twice the rooster will crow before he denies him. If you notice, I took all the passages and they all have a rooster crows, then it has the rooster, a, all the way through. It's actually a verb, and they're translating it as a noun. So this is part of what's going on here. Let me show you a few more. In the Greek, you'll see there are no articles. There's no article there, there's no article there. Eleftera is rooster, and then this is phoné is sound. So there's no article in any of these, and yet there is over here. So I just want to note that this is a subtlety of Greek language that we can't put into English. What is he talking about? Is he talking about a rooster? Any old rooster? Is that the emphasis in his Greek here he's using? He's not talking about the rooster. He's talking about a rooster, according to the translators. Or could he be talking about a rooster, a quality of rooster? And he's talking about a quality of rooster, and it becomes... And we'll look at that. But Ryrie points the same thing out here in Luke 22:61. It says, before rooster crows. It's a Roman term for the end of the third watch at 3 a.m. I think it's a little more approximate than that. But if you've ever been around roosters, they're not right at sunrise. They go off in the middle of the night. But it's farther along. It's sometimes two, three, four in that time frame. This is a period of time. If you look over in your Ryrie Study Bible, if you have one, at page 1604, you'll actually see a chart where they laid it out. But it's a time of night. It's like we say, four night, midnight, sunrise. It's a quality of time. It's not pointing out a rooster crows. That's not the significance. It's rooster crow time.
Oh, see?
Yeah. And that's why we don't have an article there, and that's why we shouldn't translate with an A. It's not so much it's going to be when a rooster, but it's at rooster crow time. Before rooster crow time finishes, you'll deny me three times. And that's what happens. And I know it's a subtlety, but I like that, that God's word is clear and consistent. Other people have noted the same thing. The Net Bible says the occurrence of the word for rooster is anarthrous. Anarthrous in Greek means there's no article. It means we're emphasizing equality. And consequently may not point back explicitly to the rooster or any other a rooster, which had crowed previously. And the reason for the anarthrous construction is most likely to indicate generically that some rooster, it's rooster crow time. I think if Linda was here, she could help us out. The translations of rooster with an indefinite noun retains the subtlety of a Greek, of the Greek in only hinting at the Lord's prediction. In other words, it's the quality of the time rather than any special rooster. So there's not really a problem with an error in the Bible. It's just a subtlety, I think. We even have it in English. Herman Melville quotation, faith phantoms, phantoms that he raised from the myth slide away and disappear as ghosts at cockcrow and da-da-da. So we've heard that in many stories that we've read. It's the same thing that's being used here in the Greek. It's rooster crow time. I know. Okay, third. Now this is the third trial, religious trial that he's undergone. He's gone to Annas, the godfather high priest, if you will. He's gone to Caiaphas, the present high priest, who is the son-in-law of Annas. And now he's going to be put before the Sanhedrin, and they're going to also violate their own written rules, and they're also going to declare him dead. Back to Mark 15:1. It says, early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders and the scribes and the whole council, in other words, the whole of them that were gathered together, it's a quorum, immediately held a consultation. And binding Jesus, they led him away to be delivered to Pilate. So by holding a consultation, that's just like a group think, right? We all agree. But nobody voted by their own written rules. They're supposed to individually vote, guilty or not guilty, starting with the youngest one. They don't do that. This is the Sanhedrin, at least as many as they could get gathered together that night. In Matthew 27:1, same event, it says, now when morning came, so they've been going at this all night long, trying to find witnesses, trying to get him convicted for a death penalty that they can control. They never arrive there successfully. But they do declare that he's been blasphemous, he's a blasphemer, and that he's guilty of death, and that's their consensus. Notice in 27 it says they, all the chief priests and the elders of the people conferred together against Jesus to put him to death. So there's no voting. This is what we're going to do. Yeah, let's do it. It's a sham. It's a kangaroo trial. And in Luke, now we learn the same thing. And when it was day, notice now we're down to day. In other words, sunrise has happened. The council of the elders of the people assembled, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council chamber saying, if you're the Christ, tell us, da-da-da-da-da. We heard this in front of Caiaphas. They do the same thing to him. And they all said, you are the Son of God then. And he said to them, yes, I am. And they say to him, what further need do we have of testimony? They don't even go ahead with the trial. They just, boom, that's it. For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth. Then the whole body of them got up and brought him before Pilate. Again, these things are illegal by their own set of rules, but they go ahead and do it anyway because it's predetermined. They want to kill Christ. He's a problem for them. But we do realize now it's daylight, it's day, so it's sunrise. And at sunrise, of course, the official Roman government opens just like the Curry County Courthouse opens. And that's where they're heading. They're going to take him up there to see Pilate. Pilate is the Roman governor of this region. Again, there's four specific violations, again, of their own written rules. So this is the overview we're still following. They've done this, they've done this. We just finished now with the Sanhedrin, and their death sentence has always been, here he said, okay, execute Jesus. Here, he comes up with a charge of blasphemy, sentence of death, And the Sanhedrin agrees and affirms, but they don't vote. They just all agree, and they carry him off, and now they take him to the civil authorities because they don't have the authority to execute capital punishment cases. Only in the case when they violate the temple. And they couldn't prove he violated the temple, so now they're stuck. They need a way to execute him. They know they're going to do it, and they need a way to execute him. So now this begins the civil trials, or the trials of Jesus before Pilate the first time. He'll be back there a second time, but this is the first time. And it's covered in Mark 15, 1 through 5, Matthew 27, 2, 11 through 14, Luke 23, 1 through 5, John 18, 28 through 38. And this is pretty much information that's obtainable through a Harmony of the Gospels by A.T. Robertson. So in Mark 15, where we were, early in the morning, the chief elders with the chief priests with the elders and scribes and the whole council immediately held a consultation, binding Jesus. They lead him away and deliver him to Pilate. Pilate is the Roman governor of this region. And in verse 2 it says, Pilate questions him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answers him, "It is as you say." The chief priests begin to accuse him harshly. Then Pilate questioned him again, saying, "Do you not answer? See how many charges they bring against you?" But Jesus made no further answer, and so Pilate was amazed, because he has to realize the seriousness of the situation he's in. But notice the things that have changed. The fact that Jesus does not reply to any of the charges amazes Pilate, because he knows that he has the power of life and death over a non-Roman. Notice this phrase, "How many charges?" I thought he was being charged with blasphemy. And now they have how many charges? So they're changing their charges to get a conviction in a civil court. They know Pilate won't regard blasphemy as anything he cares about. He'll say, it's a religious thing. Go take care of it yourself. And of course that question will come up. But it's interesting how subtly you see things are being changed. The kangaroo court is being operated. The name Pilate is a very frequent name in Scripture, in fact. These are all the names in Scripture, probably, close to it. But Pilate is more frequently named than all of the disciples except two. So he's a very major player, and we want to at least identify who he is. But Jesus, 566 times, John, 106, Peter, 96, and then it's Simon, 62. But there's Pilate at 51 times, just in the Gospels. So that's a pretty major player, and we want to make sure we identify him. Now remember, this is now morning, so we're sometime after sunrise, sometime before 9, because we know that Christ was put on the cross about 9 a.m. So these trials occur between 7 and 9, between 6:30 and 9. I would imagine government opened up, you know, sometime in the morning, probably closer to 7 than 8, and we have these three trials proceeding. On Passover. Of course, Passover means nothing to the Romans except a lot of troublesome Jews are in town. We probably have close to 1 million Jews that come for Passover, and so they're camped all around the city. It's a huge number of people. That's why Pilate's there. That's why Herod's there. They want to keep the peace, take care of any problems arise as quickly as possible. So, huge flux of people, and they're, of course, on their most guarded behavior here during this holiday. Pilate. Pilate was the fifth Roman governor of Judea. Now, this is after Herod the Great. He was there, and then after that, they didn't give... they gave Roman authority over Judea rather than some of Herod's sons. Some of Herod's sons controlled parts, tetrarchs, quarter pieces, but they didn't control the whole thing. But Pilate was. He was a Roman, and he was the governor of Judea. He was appointed by the emperor Tiberius, and he had unlimited civil, military, and criminal jurisdiction. And he served from 26 to 36 A.D. This trial occurs probably about 30 A.D. in the middle of his term. He is subordinate. He has a boss, and that is the judge, or it's called in Rome, legal system, a legate, but he's a legal type of person. So he's like the judge governor over the entire province of Syria, which is a large area. So everybody has somebody above him, which is organized, as you'd expect, by the Romans. We know about five, from history, we know about five antagonistic episodes against the Jews. Pilate and the Jews always have had friction back and forth. And let me give you those. When he first came to Rome in 26 AD, he directed the Roman army. Now remember, he is commander-in-chief of the Roman army. He directed the Roman army to encamp and display the Roman seals and standards. You know, put up the American flag. It's your base now. But those are pagan standards, and they show symbols of worshiping the emperor as God. And so they affected the Jews greatly. And he did this right next to the temple, the fortress of Antonio. And the Jews, by the thousands, traveled to his headquarters in Caesarea to incessantly complain to him. Matter of fact, they were going to commit suicide. They so much hated him having these pagan symbols around the temple. And he finally relented. He relented because Herod, Antipas, the Herod we're going to meet in the story, turned him into Tiberius, the emperor, that Pilate was causing trouble. And that was the source of their friction, why they never got along after that. Because Pilate always remembered that Herod had turned him in. And the emperor actually told Pilate to remove the troops and the symbols from the city. The main thing the Romans wanted was peace. They wanted to collect taxes. So that was the most important thing for the Romans. We know that Pilate murdered some Jewish Galileans during a sacrifice. That's recorded in Luke 13, 1. Luke 13, 1 makes that comment about Pilate's action. Now on the same occasion, there were some present who reported to him about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. So they're reporting to Jesus and talking about this event. So we know that's another episode where Pilate has friction with the Jews. He appropriated the temple funds from the temple treasury for public projects. And those that complained, he beat into silence. He just literally beat him to death. So he stole money whenever he needed money, which was kind of par for the course for some of the Roman leaders at that time. He displayed memorials, or would say sculptures, or shields with images on, with Caesar's divinity, and he hung them at the palace, his palace, in Jerusalem. And of course, that was another issue of friction, which he was turned into Tiberius and the emperor, and he told him to remove those. Now that happened 1 year before this trial takes place. So you might say Pilate's on a short lease with the emperor. He has unlimited power, but he has been reprimanded twice, and he realizes that. So that makes a factor in how he reacts to what the Jews are asking him to execute Christ. He doesn't want to get himself in trouble again. The last time that I could find an example of Pilate's episodes is he murdered a bunch of civilians who were gathering at Mount Gerizim. Mount Gerizim is where the people and the law made their agreement. That got him into trouble, and Tiberius pulled him out of there as a governor. But you can tell he has no qualms about killing, murdering, looting, stealing. It's mainly he wants to stay in power. And these things play a factor as we go through the trial of Christ. Normally, Pilate would have been in his headquarters. His headquarters is on the coast of the Mediterranean. It's at Caesarea. And this is the port of Caesarea from the backside. This is not my photograph, Bonnie. We walked down this pathway into the harbor. This is a man-made harbor. And I'll show you another couple of pictures. The Romans invented hydraulic concrete. They invented the idea of being able to put concrete down underwater. Nobody could ever do that. But they actually built a harbor where it's just a smooth coastline. And this is Caesarea. And it was the capital and where Pilate had his headquarters. They're in Jerusalem to hold down the problems, but this is where he would normally be. There are quite a few structures left. This is the amphitheater at Caesarea, and we were there, of course, and this is, it has a significance. Here's another view. This, of course, wasn't there in Roman times, but I'm actually sure they had some sort of covering, because that was pretty common in amphitheaters and stadiums to have a covering, but obviously this wasn't. But it's a beautiful location. I mean, if you can think, you're looking right here, right out at the ocean. And they don't do the same thing on John's TV, do they? What I wanted to bring to your attention, in this area back here, where you see little stones on platforms, is actually the only evidence we have that Pontius Pilate ever existed. We have two historians that write a little bit about him, Josephus and Tacitus. Tacitus was a Roman historian. And back here is a stone by Pilate dedicating a temple to Tiberius. And his name's on there, Pontius Pilate. And so it's another one of those little archaeology things that doesn't prove the Bible, but you know what? It sure confirms it. And you really can't tell it, but up here at the top you might see Tiberium, and then down here there's P-I-L-A-T and a V-S. Pilate. Pontius Pilate. And so when the archaeologists do their little extra work with it, you can see it on some pictures better than this. It says, to the honorable God, Tiberium, Pontius Pilate, perfect. And that was a new thing. We always thought he was procreator. Perfect was even a higher office of Judea, and it is a dedication stone to the temple he did. So that was found in 1961 at Caesarea. We didn't even know it when we were there. So that was something. It was in the book. I looked at the book. It was there, but you know, we never even walked by it. So the actual stone is in a museum in the Israel Museum. They have a replica here, though, for us. So if we would have just walked back there, it would have been there. Anyway, you get smarter. Another picture, and this thing is beautiful. You can stand here on the stage, talk in your normal voice. You can hear it up there. It's great for acoustics. They use it all the time now. Actually, Caesarea is kind of in a upscale neighborhood. There's a golf course down the road and different things like that. There's always tourists, you know. Everywhere you go, there's tourists. This is kind of an interesting place as well because nobody. This amphitheater also has another significant event that happened here, probably. This amphitheater, or possibly in that amphitheater, may have been the spot where Herod Agrippa I was struck with an illness that led to his death. Remember in Acts where these people acclaimed him, "You're a god, you're a god," and then he dies? This is the theater. Possibly could have happened. But it's certainly in Caesarea. Yeah. Well, it doesn't say the worms came out immediately, but it does say, yeah. So now, where are we in Jerusalem? We know we're going to see Pilate. We're at the location there where the green circle is. That's 6 and 7 is under that green circle. So we think that's where Annas and Caiaphas lived, and that's where Christ was tried. 4 is where he had the Passover meal. And this map, at least, has the assumption that they take him to Pilate over in this direction to the fortress of Antonio. And I'll show you a picture of that fort in just a minute. But it's a fort where all the Roman soldiers are at. It says they took him to the Praetorium. And we just don't know where the Praetorium is for sure. This is an educated guess and a very good traditional one. So same thing in the photograph. We're back in that area. And they take him through the city along here. And then they take him to the fort that's right alongside the temple compound. This big fort with the four pillars on the side. The Romans liked the Jews to know that they were in charge and they would, you know, control everything. So they had a tower built so they could see into the temple compound, see what's going on. It's a massive fort. It's no longer there, but it was massive at the time, as you can see. Now, is this the place they took Christ? This is the traditional location. Here's an alternate location. They're going to take him to Pilate, and Pilate stays at this location here. This is called Herod the Great's palace. But there's no Herod the Great. He died, right? And little Herod, Herod Antipas, who's the one we're dealing with in the story, he only has a quarter share. He's not quite as... So when Pilate comes, who has the same rulership, we might say, as Herod the Great does, he occupies this. This is where he stays. So when they took him to see Pilate, Pilate was here, is another possible location. So did they just take Jesus to the outside, and that's where he meets with Pilate? What becomes interesting about this possibility is this area here was all encampment by a million people. So there's all these people here for Passover who are camped with their families. They're there, and guess what? It's all in plain view what's happening with Jesus and Pilate. If that was the case, the second option, I'll show you the pictures, at least for the model in Jerusalem, it's over in the area where the circle is. They don't have to go very far. This is the front part of the fort. One of the towers is still standing. Here's a little bit longer section. A little bit more. A little bit more. So it's a large, massive area that's a palace. We think that's probably, at least I think that's where Pilate was. So it includes even the fort part up here in the front and then the luxury part here. So we don't know, you know, the chief priest might have been right outside here and this might have been where they had Christ. So they just go outside. They're not going to go into a Gentile residence and become filthy or unclean for Passover. And we'll see that brought up here a little bit later. Let's talk about Roman law. We talked about Jewish law, how many violations they did, 22. Initially, at least, this is a very good trial. Let me talk about some things. First, it was correct to initially reject the charge without, reject the case without charges. You know, Pilate says, I find him guilty of nothing. And so Pilate was right to initially reject the case without charges. He was the correct authority to bring a capital punishment case to. So all these things are happening in accordance with Roman law at this point. He is correct to ascertain from the defendant what the treasonable actions are. You know, he talks to Jesus here in a little bit and asks him questions. Are you the king? Are you the king of the Jews? And that's a correct action to do. It's correct for him to use other experts. When he sends him to Herod, that's okay. He's sending him to another expert to also examine Jesus and see if he sees something. So again, those are correct actions on his part. Five, the trial must be public, and it was. It was out in a location where the public could watch and see this. And then I think it was correct also in the sense it began with a charge, which is the opposite of the Jewish trial. The Jewish trial is supposed to begin with the defense first, and I know that seems kind of odd to us. But the Romans here, their procedure was that the prosecution must begin with a charge. And so that's what Pilate is asking of the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders of the council, is what is he guilty of? And they begin coming up with all these reasons. They never mention blasphemy. Pilate, in his position, was a provincial governor, a perfect, and he had the legal freedom to conduct a trial as informally and with as little set procedure as he wished. He wasn't constrained, but yet he was doing things in a legal Roman procedural manner. So for that, that's good, at least initially. Actually, for non-Romans, he didn't have any responsibility to do this at all. As a non-Roman, you're more like property. If you didn't have Roman citizenship, your property, the only thing you were good for, paying your taxes and being in submission to the Roman authorities and not causing trouble. So he really went above and beyond. He was doing things in a very good manner. We mentioned once, this is that area where the trial could have taken place, just outside this wall, outside the palace. So really what they would have had Jesus here and they would have brought him outside right here. Or they could have gone through the front gate. This is Jaffa Gate. So they could have gone right around there. Let me show you a couple pictures, and I think you'll see it. It's this area here, and I know Bonnie and I walked right by this wall. I don't remember seeing this, so I'll have to look for this for the next possibility. But there's an outcropping here just outside the wall. There is a opening where there was a doorway. So the artist's rendition of that is something like this, where there's a raised platform, a rostrum, a bema seat, where Pilate is going to judge affairs that get brought to him. He's the official Curry County Courthouse. And they just he can either come out this way and the Jews came around. That's a very possible. In this picture, it would be outside the wall here, along here. So that's that second possibility I just wanted to bring up. I like it. Nobody knows for sure where the praetorium was. Scripture says they took him to the praetorium. The praetorium is usually where the palace or the secret service, the fort is, and we don't know. It could have been the fortress of Antonio. That seems more like a military fort. It doesn't seem like the place where a high muckety-muck like a governor would be, if you know what I'm saying. So I expect the more luxurious location for him. Yes, there'd be military in that location, but if you know, remember, he also had a small fort there right next to his luxury location as well. Turn over to John 18. We'll see a little bit more that happens over there that's not in Mark. It kind of helps bring these things together. In John chapter 18, in verse 28, we begin with that same episode where they bring Christ to Pilate. So let me begin in 28 and read through 32. And they lead Jesus from Caiaphas into the praetorium. So we know he's going to the praetorium, we just don't know what the praetorium was, which location. And it was early. And they themselves did not enter into the praetorium so that they might not be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. So here's the kangaroo court mob is worried about being ceremonially unclean to eat the Passover, even though they're murdering in a travesty of justice a righteous person as Christ, and innocent. But they're worried about their... Now remember, well, I think I've got that. Let me keep on with this and get through 32. Therefore, Pilate went out to them. So he could have gone outside the wall. He could have gone outside the fortress of Antonio. It wouldn't make a difference there. Went out to them and says, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" That's the first thing in a Roman court. The prosecutor needs to bring the charge. And they answer and say to him, "If this man were not an evildoer, would we not have delivered him to him?" Excuse me. "Would we not have delivered him to you?" So it's kind of a retort to Pilate. They go, "Well, we wouldn't be here unless there was something wrong." That's the idea. You know, I don't know whether they're just tired after being up all night or not, but that's a little sharp when you're really wanting something from the governor. In 31, so Pilate says to them, "Take him yourselves, judge him according to your law," because he just wants to say, "Get out of here." The Jews say to him, "We are not permitted to put anyone to death." So there they admit it. They cannot put Jesus to death. They need Pilate's help to execute him. They couldn't convict him of doing anything against the temple, so now they're in this quandary. And of course, once they say that, I'm sure Pilate winks and goes, "Yeah, now I know why you're here." In 32, it says, "To fulfill the word of Jesus, which he spoke, signifying by what kind of death he was about to die. Jesus talked many times about his death, and it was clear he was going to die on the cross. Passover, when Jesus ate the last Passover, that is the typical time that a Jewish family would eat Passover, except for the priest. They do their sacrifice in the morning now, and the sacrifice will be, if you will, shadowing the events of Christ. They'll be sacrificing the lamb, the sacrifices, probably from 9 to 12. And that's the same time he'll be on the cross. They'll be eating the Passover sometime later that day, probably around lunch, noon. And so that's the time that sin is being dealt with, but yet they're performing their religious things. And it's quite a ironic situation, of course. Judas was the person we really needed to be here. Judas, remember, brought the charges against Jesus, got the armed guard, and went and arrested Jesus, but we've lost Judas. Judas went off and hung himself and is no longer available. And so they're bringing, who should have been here in front of Pilate, should have been Judas with Christ, bringing the charges. But he's dead already. So they're having to scramble to come up with other charges. It was actually in the same year, 30 AD, that the Jews lost authority to execute capital punishment. Notice how God times this. In the very year in which Christ is going to be executed, the Jews lose the authority to execute capital punishment cases. So up until that time, they could have stoned Jesus to death for blasphemy. But in 30 AD, the Romans took away that authority. Again, this is God's sovereign hand at work again. Because God says he's going to die on a cross for the sins of the world. Jesus stated a number of times throughout the gospel that we've studied that he would die by crucifixion, a cross death. He wasn't going to die the Jewish way, which was a stoning death. And so again, this is God's hand involved in this. The Jews are prevented from having the authority to execute Christ. They're prevented from being able to stone him. They actually have to go to the Romans, ask for permission, or get them convinced to do what they cannot do, crucify the Son of God. And again, this all comes about from God's plan. Look over at Luke 23, a couple more things. Luke 23, verses 1 through 4. And we're at the same location. Verse 1, then the whole Sanhedrin of them got up and brought him before Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, we found this man misleading our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar and saying that he himself is Christ, a king. Where did that come from? So here we have all these many charges. We have three that they've selected. He's a national heresy, and that's a big deal in ancient times. He's guilty of tax evasion. Well, that's what the only thing the Romans wanted the non-Romans for, is taxes. And he's guilty of insurrection. He's claiming he's a king, and we only have one king but Caesar. And, of course, this is what gets really funny here. So Pilate asked him, oops, I skipped the verse, didn't I? And they begin to accuse him, okay, da-da-da. Verse 3, so Pilate asked him, Christ, saying, are you the king of the Jews? And he answered him and said, it is as you say. Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowd, I find no guilt in this man. So the preliminary finding is, there's nothing here. He says he's a king, that's no big deal. I mean, he's just saying stuff. But they kept insisting, saying, he stirs up the people, teaching all over Judea, starting from Galilee, even as far as this place. The moment they say the word Galilee, a little light bulb goes like, ding, Galilee, that's Herod's responsibility. So then he goes, I'll ship him over to Herod. Herod can deal with him. And that's what happens next in verse 6, where we're at in Luke. When Pilate heard it, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, and he sent him to Herod, who himself also was in Jerusalem at that time. And Herod was very glad when he saw Jesus. We'll get to that in a minute. But notice what happens. They continue to change charges. They never bring up the idea of blasphemy. They start off with this, he misleads our nation. He's not paying taxes, or he's forbidding. And of course, Jesus said exactly the opposite. Give unto Caesar what is due Caesar, right? So they're making up all these bogus charges, finding any way, anyhow, that they can do that. Yet, the preliminary finding is, he's not guilty. He's not guilty of anything. Over to John. Same thing. John 18 and verse 33. Each one, you know, is selective in the material, and you learn a little bit more about the sequence when you kind of look at all of them together. Chapter 18 of John and verse 33. Therefore, I think this is right. Yeah. So in 31, they'd already had this conversation, take him yourself and judge him according to laws. The Jews say to him, we're not permitted to put anybody to death. Of course, that probably got a smile out of Pilate. And then 33, therefore Pilate entered again into the praetorium and summoned Jesus, brought him inside. So he's going to talk to him a little bit more, interrogate him, and says to him, are you the king of the Jews? Jesus answered, Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me? Which is very insightful, because Pilate wouldn't have known what to ask otherwise. 35, Pilate answered, I am not a Jew, am I? And of course he wasn't. Your own nation and the chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done? And Jesus answered, My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm. Therefore Jesus says to him, So you are a king. Jesus answered, You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who hears, who is of the truth, hears my voice. And a typical intellectual answer is, what is truth? You know, there's 15 ways to split a hair. What is truth? 39, but you have a custom, and then at some point here, he sends him to Pilate, or Herod, and I think probably at this point he sends him, because now he begins to deal about this issue of releasing somebody at Passover, Barabbas, and that comes up a little bit later. So he next, in the sequence, sends him to Herod. And back in Luke 23:5-7, you see a little bit more of the sequence there. Herod comes out, says, I find no guilt in this man. In verse 5, they kept on insisting, saying, he stirs up the people, teaching all over Galilee, da-da-da. And then he hears about the Galilee thing, and I think I got that out of sequence. I should have had that here, shouldn't I? So he hears about the Galilee thing, and then he sends him over to Herod. And that's probably where I want to stop there. The next thing, he arrives at Herod, and Herod, again, is the guy that killed John the Baptist. So Herod's been wanting to see Jesus for a long time. He invited Jesus to see him one time, and Jesus turned him down. Called him a fox, which is another way of saying you're a wimp. I'm not going there. So it becomes kind of an interesting meeting as well. So we've covered the first trial with Pilate. We'll do Herod, and then the last trial with Pilate, and the release of the prisoner Barabbas, who's very popular. And the funny thing is, they accuse Christ of being a king of the Jews. That's his thing he is convicted of and is executed for. And what do? They release an insurrectionist, somebody who's trying to overthrow the government. You know, it's just amazing the ironies involved. Yes, question. Yeah, that's a historian note. It's actually the rabbis that record it, and they record that they lost the ability to execute. The Romans took their authority away to execute 40 years before the end of the temple. Well, the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. 40 years back is 30 AD. So, you know, God's hand is working sovereignly at that point. Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus. Yeah.
They definitely would have voted not guilty, yeah. But then would have made
it more like a valid trial.
A valid trial.
Yeah.
So not they didn't have to go through that. I thought it was really awesome.
Yeah.
And the fact that you see God's hand in all of this is just wow.
Well, that was the way we should understand it. You know, that we haven't even been taking enough time. I said there was 365 prophecies in the Old Testament, at least, of things that Christ fulfills in the New Testament about Him being the Messiah. And, yeah, it's just awesome. Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, I can get that too. When I go back and forth, sometimes it's not an exact match. You know, it's not like he stops here and then you continue. They overlap, and sometimes that gets a little confusing. But if you kind of spend a little time with it, I think it really works pretty well. The events were certainly factual. They happened. It's just each author chose certain things to emphasize and record, because Matthew wants to tell you that he's the king of the Jews. He's the Messiah. Mark wants to show he's the servant, but he was a man of action. He did exactly what his Father God had sent him to do. John wants you to know he's divine, he's God-man, all those kind of things. So it's not just four identical episodes of his life. That's not what it is. Makes it pretty neat. Well, let's close. Father, again, we thank you for your word. We especially thank you that you've taken the time to have recorded by godly men the Gospels. They are portraits of your Son. They are portraits about your Son in different aspects. We learn so much about his character, about your love for us, about your hand in history, the fact that these events would happen in such a way that it perfectly fulfills the things that you've written in your word. It's not like Mount Olympus where God comes down and moves people around. It's just the events of history are laid out in such a way that you accomplish your plan of grace no matter what obstruction men place in the way, no matter what obstruction Satan places in the way. You have carried through your plan of love towards us by having your Son die on the cross in the way that you testified he fulfilled. He fulfilled it perfectly, completely, and infinitely. We thank you for this record so that we can learn about what he's done. In his name we praise you. Amen.